You're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com.
This is episode 18 of the Short Story Geeks podcast for January 5th, 2012, with your hosts, The Niche, Buck Turner, and Graveyard Greg. Sponsored by GnomeCo Publications, the hardest working gnomes on the web, at gnomecopublications.com. That's GnomeCo with a G. Hello, and welcome to the Short Story Geeks podcast. I am your host, The Niche, and with me I have...
This is Buck Turner.
And this is Graveyard Greg.
This week we've actually got a pretty good selection of short story headlines, so we're going to jump right into those. And Greg is up first.
All right, over at Terrible Minds, which is at terribleminds.com, there is a flash fiction challenge. It is the revenge of the subgenre mashup. There's a list of six subgenres, you choose two. Then you mash them together into a single piece of flash fiction, no more than 1,000 words long. And the list is dystopian sci-fi, cozy mysteries, slasher or serial killer, lost world, spy fiction, or the Bodice Ripper. You have 1 week, and by the time this podcast is published, you actually have 1 day. But still, it's a good exercise for people who want to write. Just write 1,000 words, combine the two, boom, you're good.
If you're quick enough, 1,000-word story, you can bang it out pretty quickly. So.
If you're quick enough. I imagine you, Nietzsche, could be very good with the, say, like, we'll say, oddly enough, I think you could do it with a cozy mystery and spy fiction.
Not dystopian sci-fi and Bodice Ripper?
I don't think a slasher or serial killer would work for you.
No, probably not.
No.
I just end up doing the Death Chicken of San Diego again.
Which I'm still... I've always wondered about that, but that's beside the point.
All right. Well, my story, we have over at the Chronicle of Higher Education, there's a guest blogger piece, Blackwell on Writing, The Long and Very Short of It, by Elise Blackwell. And this is sort of a overview of sort of the chronic short story is dead, long live the short story kind of piece that comes up over and over and over again. In this particular case, she's talking about how the short story collection has its issues right now. Typically, in the past, people would write short stories for magazine publication and then publish a bunch together in an anthology, etc. And that's not going as well as it has been right now, just like everything else in the print world, it's sort of shaking up. On the other hand, individual short stories are getting a lot more attention because they're appearing online, especially, you know, the flash fiction we've talked before about, very short pieces, like Greg's story, the 1,000 words or less. There's a lot of strength going on with that, especially with the internet. They're quick to read, they're quick to write, compared to a lot of other stories, so they fit the web very well. And this particular piece is just a discussion of that, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. And then we have Greg again.
Over at openculture.com, there is an article based on Neil Gaiman's Free Short Stories and New Year's Wishes. Neil Gaiman, of course, is one of the handful of writers who has made comics respectable over the past several decades, one comic being Sandman. If you've never read Sandman and you're not much of a comic book reader, give it a try anyway. It's good. He's also written some children's stories like The Graveyard Book and Coraline. Coraline, of course, was made into a movie. Pretty good movie, too. And one of his novels is going to be adapted by HBO. They are planning 6 seasons of this novel. It is called American Gods.
And wow.
If you haven't read American Gods, it's good. And for fans of Game of Thrones, HBO is probably a perfect place for American Gods because it's got sex, drugs, rock and roll, and gods. Now, some of these stories by Neil Gaiman are available in audio and video, but the ones in text are the ones that intrigue me the most. One of them, I, Cthulhu. And I think I'm going to be reviewing that one next time we do a podcast, because it's about Cthulhu. You can't go wrong with that. And the New Year's Benediction, this was delivered to a crowd in Boston several years ago, and if you don't mind, I'm just going to read it, because it's pretty appropriate being the New Year. May your coming year be filled with magic and dreams and good madness. I hope you read some fine books and kiss someone who thinks you're wonderful. And don't forget to make some art. Write or draw or build or sing or live as only you can. May your coming year be a wonderful thing in which you dream both dangerously and outrageously. I hope you will make something that didn't exist before you made it, that you will be loved and you will be liked, and you will have people to love and to like in return. And most importantly, because I think there should be more kindness and more wisdom in the world right now, I hope that you will, when you need to, be wise and that you will always be kind. And I hope that somewhere in the next year, you surprise yourself. I think that last line should be remembered by all of us, that somewhere in the next year, we surprise ourselves.
Okay. I heard Neil Gaiman read one of his short stories at Balticon one year. It was very cool. You know, he has this whole sort of British rock star sound to his speech, so it's a story being narrated by, like, a teenage girl, except it's this teenage girl with his British rock star voice. It's a pretty strange event, but I enjoyed it.
Well, Neil Gaiman's a pretty strange guy. He seems pretty awesome.
He is. He is. Anyhow, Buck, we move on to you.
Well, speaking of flash fiction and the short stories, etc., on the internet, this headline is from the New York Times Sunday Book Review, and it is a review of a new book, 420 Characters, written and illustrated by Lou Beach, and it talks about this book, which basically looks like a collection of microfiction. The title comes from the previous Facebook limitation of 420 characters to do a status update on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And so some of these stories were originally published by him on his Facebook, and really kind of shows putting together a flash fiction and then put it together enough of them and get it published, not unlike the Nietzsche has done. Though his are not yet on the in the New York Times book review section.
I wish.
Yeah. It did give it a pretty favorable review. It's fairly short collection. They said pretty easy to get through in one or two sittings. But it is actually, they say, really good despite kind of the limitations of the story that he manages to get a lot into these very short bites.
All right. Cool. And finally, we have one that we're all going to talk about a little bit. It's in the Los Angeles Times. It's 25 Literary Resolutions for 2012. And what this is they just got a bunch of writers and said, what are your literary resolutions? You know, instead of, are you going to quit smoking? Are you going to get diet and get more exercise? Blah, blah, give us something literary. So these range from, I'm going to try to write every day, or I'm going to try to read every day, to I'm going to go back and reread Moby Dick, or I'm going to stop looking at so much porn. And think, you know, just anything having to do with what people read. So why don't we talk about what our literary resolutions are for the year? And we'll put Greg on the spot first, because he went first with the headlines too.
Oh, fine. Well, my literary resolution is to write another novella and complete it and publish it. And if I'm really lucky, I'll try to get two novellas published. And of course, I'll continue to write webcomics. Getting them out there on the web, well, that's up to the artists.
All right. Buck, you want to do yours?
Well, I've never been one much for resolutions, but...
Well, it can just be what your plan is, you know.
Yeah, but that being said, I am intending to have out another anthology this summer, so we'll be working on that, and... I may try to squeeze in some time to actually do some writing of my own at some point. We'll see how that goes.
All right. Well, let's see. My literary resolutions. Well, first, I'm going to keep the podcast going for as long as we're all interested in doing it. I assume that counts as a literary resolution, since it's about short stories. But on a more personal angle, I would like to get at least one more story published by somebody other than me this coming year. And I've got the comic coming out starting in January 9th, so I do a lot of writing for that, but that's not that much in terms of actual prose. That's, you know, I'm writing dialogue, I'm coming up with a plot. And I think the other thing I would like to do is pick a novel or one of my longer projects that's sort of been sitting on the back burner and try to make some significant progress on it. But I haven't decided which one yet.
Volume 3 of Bridget and Greg.
That's a different story.
Well, yeah, it is a different story.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
This year I resolve to maybe look at Volume 3 of Bridget and Greg if I feel like it. How's that? All right. Well, I think that's it for the headlines. And we got a piece of feedback this past week, or this past couple of weeks. This one is from Fuzz Wolf, who is one of our pals over at Fur Planet.
Hooray!
And he writes, "Hello, geeks. Earlier tonight, I randomly remembered a short story I had read when I was a teenager. I don't recall whether it was in high school or even junior high school, but this story had been in my English textbook. I did not recall the name of the story or the author, but thanks to Google, I was able to find it based on the vague search terms of short story train station time travel." You know, there's actually been quite a few of those. Anyway, turns out the story I was thinking of is The Third Level by Jack Finney. This is apparently a quite well-known story of his, but he is more known for writing the original novel The Body Snatchers, which the Invasion of the Body Snatchers film was based upon. I was just wondering if any of the geeks had read this short story or any of Finney's other work. I'd be interested to hear some commentary on him. If you haven't read it, here's the site where I found the story online, boom, and a link, and the Wikipedia link. Thanks, and keep up the great work on the show. Well, first off, thank you very much for the note, Fuzzwolf. I had not heard of Jack Finney specifically, or if I had, I had forgotten it. I read a lot of this type of stuff when I was in school. You know, there's a lot of these short story writers who were sort of big in the 50s and 60s, who wrote things that the sci-fi movies and like episodes of Twilight Zone and stuff were based on, ended up in the kind of books that I read a lot in high school. So it's entirely possible that I read a ton of Jack Finney and didn't realize that's who it was. However, I did take this story that you wrote about as my discussion topic for this week, so we'll get into that in the discussion. Are either of you guys familiar with Jack Finney?
Never familiar with Jack Finney. In fact, I didn't even know Invasion of the Body Snatchers was based on a novel.
Okay.
Yeah. Although I did like the Donald Sutherland version.
Yeah, it's just looking at the bibliography of his work. Nothing pops out that I recognize, but that doesn't necessarily mean I haven't read it, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, based on the one story here that he sent that I read, I wouldn't be at all surprised if I read a Jack Finney story in one of my anthologies of creepy stories. Mm-hmm. You know, the publishers of Weird Tales, I think it is, have published over the years a ton of these collected anthologies of creepy stories on a theme. You know, 100 ghoulish ghost stories and 100 scary spook stories and 100 monster stories, etc. So, assuming that Finney has written four Weird Tales, it could be that I've read it. This stuff in there, but like I say, I don't know him by name. Alright, so from here we will move on into the discussion section.
Listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com has been clinically proven to make you smarter and more attractive. That's shortstorygeeks.com.
Not actually clinically proven. May cause confusion or spontaneous fits of giggling. Void where prohibited.
So, this story that was recommended by Fuzz is called The Third Level, and what this is it's just sort of a rambling recount from this guy who has found a third level in New York Grand Central Station. Now, what's unusual about that is that Grand Central Station only has two levels. So he was a little concerned by this, and I'm going to read you just the opening of the story to give you sort of an idea of what it's like. It's a very short story, so what I'm going to read you ends up being almost a fifth of the story, but it's what you need to get it set up. The presidents of the New York Central and the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroads will swear on a stack of timetables that there are only two. But I say there are three, because I've been on the third level at Grand Central Station. Yes, I've taken the obvious step. I talked to a psychiatrist friend of mine, among others. I told him about the third level at Grand Central Station, and he said it was a waking dream wish fulfillment. He said I was unhappy. That made my wife kind of mad, but he explained that he meant the modern world is full of insecurity, fear, war, worry, and all the rest of it, and that I just want to escape. Hell, who doesn't? Everybody I know wants to escape, but they don't wander down to any third level at Grand Central Station. But that's the reason, he said, and my friends all agreed. Everything points to it, they claimed. My stamp collecting, for example. That's a temporary refuge from reality. Well, maybe. But my grandfather didn't need any refuge from reality. Things were pretty nice and peaceful in his day, from all I hear, and he started my collection. It's a nice collection, too. Blocks of four of practically every U.S. issue, first day covers, and so on. President Roosevelt collected stamps, too, you know. Anyway, here's what happened at Grand Central. One night last summer, I worked late at the office. I was in a hurry to get uptown to my apartment, so I decided to take the subway from Grand Central because it's faster than the bus. Now, I don't know why this should have happened to me. I'm just an ordinary guy named Charlie, 31 years old, and I was wearing a tan gabardine suit and a straw hat with a fancy band. I passed a dozen men who looked just like me, and I wasn't trying to escape from anything. I just wanted to get home to Louisa, my wife. So that's how it starts. And the reason I didn't want to read any further is because there's not much more than that. He discovers this third level of Grand Central Station, where everybody's dressed in clothes from the 1800s, he finds a newspaper called The World, which had not been published for decades by the time the story was written. The lead story said something about President Cleveland. I found that front page since in the public library files, and it was printed June 11, 1894. So somehow he wandered down a corridor back into time, and as soon as he got there, he realized that he could go anywhere he wanted in the 1800s, and he knew about this little town where his grandfather lived, and he always wanted to go there. So he tries to buy a ticket, but he's only got modern money, and the guy won't take his money. So he's like, okay, here's what I'll do. I'll go back out through the regular train station, go to an antique dealer, and buy a bunch of old money. And that's what he does. But when he comes back to Grand Central Station the next day to buy his ticket to go wherever, he can't find the way to the third level again. So there's sort of this air of lost opportunity here. You know, if he'd only, for some reason, been carrying 1890s money in his pocket, he could have had this great adventure. And that's sort of the premise of the story, and it's most of the plot in a nutshell, except sort of the twist at the end, which I don't want to spoil. But it's a very economical story, which is something very cool. There's nothing in there. Even the little reference about his grandfather starting his stamp collection is there for a reason. There's nothing in there that just sort of ended up there. It's not a flourish. Everything is there specifically to do something, which is very cool. And really, I don't have a whole lot more to say about it other than check it out, read it. There's a link on the website. And I will certainly be looking for other stuff by this author now that I know who he is. This was published in Collier's in 1950, so that gives you sort of an idea of the time frame. Like I mentioned before, it has that sort of Twilight Zone kind of feel to it. And I recommend it, and I've probably talked longer about it than it would take you to read it, so go check it out. Next, we have Greg.
Okay, my review is going to be slightly shorter than Nietzsche's review of The Third Level. This is a story called See the Woman by a very renowned author, Lawrence Block. He's responsible for a lot of characters, the recovering alcoholic P.I. private investigator Matthew Scudder, gentleman burglar Bernie Rodenbaugh, and which was based on a horrible movie called Burglar with Whoopi Goldberg as Bernice. So yeah. But this story is from the collection of L.A. Noir, The Collected Stories. It's about
Based on the
video game, which, by the way, for you with an Xbox or PS3, very excellent game, but that's beside the point.
Actually, it's out on PC, too. I got that.
It is out on PC, but why would you want to do it on the PC?
Because I have
it. That's a whole nother discussion, though. Anyway, the story opens up, anyway, let me get to this, to a retired officer. He's in the twilight of his years, and he's talking to somebody who's basically off-panel, if you want to get into that, and he's recounting his memoirs. He's basically talking to a recorder, talking about, you know, his past, how he's, he remembers some things and doesn't remember others, but he recalls his life as a police officer. He's a plainclothes detective. They basically paired him up with an older gentleman about, 20 years older than him, and showing him the ropes and stuff, and they would mainly do domestic disturbances, or as they would just call it, domestics. The dialogue would be like, they give you an address, and it's like, see the wife. And the more experienced partner, his name is Lou, L-E-W, he would always complain about how it would always turn into, the husband beats up the wife, but as soon as we get there, it's going to be them against us. Oh, no, officer, he only drinks on days ending with Y. Oh, we're married. Oh, what would I do if he went to jail? And there was one recurring call from this husband and wife. Husband would normally be passed out drunk, and the wife would usually be there to meet the officers and say, oh, it was just an accident. And apparently Lou does have a history with this woman, because he remarks about how she used to be so beautiful until Joe, the husband, got his claws onto her. He would never explain to the younger officer how he knew her. And then at one point, the call came out. It gave him the address, see the husband. And they, Lou made the joke of, oh, so what happened? Did she beat him up? And only it turns out it's not quite that simple. He beat her a little too much, and her neck was broken. Lou is, of course, very sad about this, but in some ways, he's finally going to be able to give the husband the justice that he deserves. He's going to be going to, I think the prison is San Quentin. He's going to go to the joint, probably going to be there for life, if not, you know, killed because, you know, giving the death sentence because of what he's done. And then, just like that, she opens her eyes. She's still alive, hanging on by a thread, and just like that, she gives him, once again, the way out simply by opening her eyes. The story will continue, the story does go on, and I'm not going to reveal what happens, but what happens next, it's very worthwhile to read. Go get this. This and other stories from L.A. Noir, the collected stories, it's very well written. Lawrence Block, of course, knows his way around the words. He's been writing for the longest time. He's a grandmaster by the Mystery Writers of America for a reason, so I would highly recommend this.
Sounds good. Buck, what have you got?
Well, I've got something here from Clark's World. It's kind of my go-to place for finding short stories on short notice, especially when I found that the Nietzsche had swiped the Jack Finney story.
Hey man, the show notes were up for half a week.
But at any rate, I did come across an actual quite a gem of a story. It's actually from, well, I guess last month's episode or issue at this point. It's from the November 2011 issue. It's called The Smell of Orange Groves by Lavi Tindar. And it's actually a really, really interesting story. You know, again, kind of in that that classic sci-fi vein of set in a world, you know, post space travel and spaceports, but it's and also at the same time a story about kind of a really old thing here. It's the story of ostensibly the story of a man, Boris Chong, who is in Tel Aviv, roughly. It's essentially a kind of a suburb of Tel Aviv by the spaceport slash kind of arcology, if that, you know, SimCity term. This massive structure that sounds a lot like a space elevator. And it talks about his family. And it's a very kind of crazy multicultural family. They're Russian, Jewish, Chinese in ancestry. And the interesting part is that it's kind of about Boris, but it's also about his grandfather, Zhang Weiwei, who had made a bargain with the Oracle, so essentially a hyper-connected, technologically advanced person, to have his memories and all of the family's memories passed down to the kids. So it's Boris, but he also has the memories of his grandfather, of his father. And it goes on to go through about ways that's impacting him. It's just a really wonderfully described environment, you know, kind of talking about the various waves of people and, you know, the multiculturalism in the Middle East there, and kind of dealing with these, you know, memories of these different places, these different times, and these different things. And it's actually really sweet and really nice, and definitely recommend checking it out.
That's an interesting idea. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in sci-fi right now about sort of transhumanism, and that's an interesting wrinkle on it, the idea of you're not just yourself, but you're everybody who came before you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can see that being really, really cool and also really, really horrible.
Yeah. It actually, you know, his asking for this boon of the Oracle was actually a really interesting bit because, you know, it's not asking for his own immortality or anything like that, but it's a different kind of that.
Yeah, it's sort of preservation of the culture.
Right.
Sort of. Yeah. Well, that sounds like a very cool story. I'll probably check that one out.
Definitely a fun one.
All right, let's move on then to the bloody pen of the ranting editor.
You're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com. Remember, it's the stories that are short, not the geeks. The geeks are actually pretty tall.
The bloody pen of the ranting editor!
All right, so this week I wanted to talk a little bit about dialogue, working on a story, editing for the next volume of Roar, where I'm constantly coming back and giving the same little bits of feedback here and there about a lot of the dialogue, and that is that it's not really sounding authentic yet. So it's something that obviously we'll be working on. But that kind of got me thinking about, you know, writing dialogue, you know, what's missing from his dialogue as it's currently stands, is there that shouldn't be. And a lot of the things here come down to it needs to sound authentic to the characters that you're writing. And also that people are not walking exposition machines. So between the two of those, you know, when you're having characters talk, you want them to sound appropriate to their character and to the setting of the story. You know, it's not something where you're going to write a story about something set in the 20s and, you know, among adult people in the 20s, and then have it written and sound like middle class college dialogue from last week. And it's not just a matter of kind of pop cultural references, but even just the vocabulary and how you're writing things down can really, you know, kind of sound and come off inauthentic if you're not really paying attention to what you're doing with it. So really, it's just a matter of being true to your characters, knowing enough about your characters, and knowing about the period and the setting that you're working in. And certainly, if you're choosing to set your work in some other historical time frame, it's a good idea to kind of read some things that are contemporary to that, get a sense of what was going on language-wise. And also, in context of the story, is, you know, obviously people talking is a part of the story. You're moving things forward. But at the same time, when you're writing a story, you don't want the old cliche, there's Basil exposition in the Austin Powers, where the guy comes on and he doesn't do anything except tell you the next part of the story or tell you the background or the details. You know, normally people aren't going to just come out and say those kinds of things or move the story forward in a super obvious fashion by stating the obvious things or, you know, volunteering various bits of information.
Yeah, unless you're in the briefing room getting your mission from your boss.
Exactly. But I mean, even that is gonna, you know, impart certain things and not impart other things. So you really want it to, you know, to be aware when you're figuring out what are these people talking about and why are they talking in your story. You know, you don't necessarily want to, I mean, obviously, you've got a goal, you've got a place that you're getting to, a point you're getting across, but you want to make sure that as you're getting there, the dialogue is not the only way that you're getting there, or that you're not getting there with the dialogue at the expense of having it sound like a real conversation. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about with this. I think I'll leave it there for this week, but certainly we will be over the next shows and months returning to this at times.
Well, one thing I found was useful when I was learning to write dialogue, and it sounds terribly rude, but if you do it in an impersonal way, it's not so bad, which is just to go to a restaurant or a coffee house or someplace like that and just eavesdrop on people. Preferably people you don't know, so that you're not, like, getting involved, you don't put yourself into it. But just listen to how people get ideas across. You know, if people know each other, especially if they've known each other a long time, they have a close relationship already, they've got their own sort of culture of two, of shared experiences that they will refer to. It could be as simple as an inside joke, or it could be, you know, they've both grown up with the same domineering mother, so they react to certain key phrases in the same way, and so they use those phrases with each other as shorthand for this whole giant experience that they've had together. Things like that, you know, and you just, if you listen to how people talk, first of all, there's a lot of wasted stuff that has to come out of real dialogue and conversation as people are thinking about what they're going to say. You know, there's all that too, and you're going to throw all that away. But when you strip all that down, and you then find how people are interacting with each other, you usually find that most people are very economical in their communication. You know, they'll say what they want in a couple of words, and as soon as the other person gets it, they'll drop it and move on to the next idea. That's not true for everybody. There are certainly people I've met who just will harp on the same idea over and over again, or just won't shut up about something. But most people, as I say, are very, you got that idea? Great. Moving on to the next one. You got that idea? Great. Moving on to the next one. And so that's something to keep in mind with your dialogue. You have any thoughts on this, Greg?
I was going to say the same thing that you said a long time ago, someone that I respected, Back in my religious days, a minister actually said, if you want to be a good writer, you should just, you know, go out to a public place and listen. Take notes. So that's always stuck with me. And I've learned people can be very interesting with their dialogue. So you basically covered it.
Okay. Once again, I've stolen Greg's thunder. I apologize.
That's okay. My thunder is too noisy. It keeps me up at night.
All right. Well, from this, we'll move on to the intro.
Hello, listeners. How are you? Fantastic. Because you're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com. I'm wearing a headset.
Not actually Isaiah Mustafa. Isaiah Mustafa's fees are way out of our budget. Void where prohibited.
For intro this week, I have two things to plug, and they're coming up in rapid succession. First is, my new comic, Arc Light Adventures, is going to launch on January 9th. That's
Hooray!
The Monday. Yay. Monday after this comes out, and I'm not sure how many pages I will launch with. I had in mind to launch with like 4 pages up so people could have a little bit of backstory, but I don't have as much finished as I would like, so some of it is I haven't finished drawing it, some of it is it's still waiting to come back from the colorist. So,
a question on your Arc Light Adventures, how often will it update?
Assuming all goes to plan, it will update every Monday, once a week.
Very, very good start.
Yep.
But I would just advise, just release 2 pages. Play it safe.
Hmm. I might do that. I haven't decided. This weekend, I'm also concentrating on a related thing, which is putting together a flyer, a postcard flyer, to take to the next thing I'm going to plug, which is Further Confusion.
Hooray!
Which is January 12th through 16th in California. I will be there in the Furry Marketplace, which is a little sort of adjunct to the dealer room. It's sort of like an artist alley kind of thing. You come in, set up in the morning, break down in the afternoon, and come back the next day, as opposed to a persistent table, which is what I prefer to do, but I couldn't get that in time this year, unfortunately. And so I will not have any Arclight Adventures material there other than these postcards I'm putting together, but I will have Suburban Jungle, the completed Suburban Jungle collection, the complete Never Never collection, buttons, and I'll be doing on-the-spot artwork and stuff like that. So I hope people will come up and see me there, and I also hope people will buy my stuff, but, you know, really I'm there to see people first, and buying stuff is just to pay for me to be able to go there. And we will all be there at Further Confusion this year, and so we're going to try and get together and do something, and, you know, we still haven't figured out what that's going to be, so we need to work on that too. That's me, Greg.
I am jumping on the bandwagon. I am going to be talking about Further Confusion, which, in case you have forgotten, just what the niche says, January 12th through the 16th. I will be in the dealer's room most of the time behind the Fur Planet table when I can, because I've got at least 2 new releases, one of which is the anthology Fang Volume 4, which is... it's years in the making, even though it probably shouldn't have been. I helped edit it with the gracious talents of Skip, whatever his last name is. Is it Skip Rudder? Is that how he's going to call himself? Who cares? It's going to be Skip with the layout finesse of our very own Buck C. Turner. That's you, Buck.
Alrighty.
And what I am pleased for, which it was years in the making for me, at least maybe 1 year, maybe 2, is Welcome to Cappuccinos, my first novel, partly inspired by John the Nietzsche's writing, believe it or else. It was. You did inspire the creation of Welcome to Cappuccinos, and so did Starbucks, but that's beside the point.
Well, I'm pleased that to have been of service.
Yep, that will be at Further Confusion. I will also, if I'm not at the dealer's table, I'm probably going to be pestering the niche, because it's fun. I actually have that in the show notes. And finally, I have a question for our listeners. To you, listeners, who are experts at the e-books, I have an Amazon gift card. It is worth a certain amount. What do you think I should buy, ebook-wise, at Amazon.com? I have my ideas, but I'd be interested in listening to your ideas, or, you know, reading them. And that's it for me.
Well, this week I'm also kind of plugging the upcoming Further Confusion appearance. I will be also at the Fur Planet table for probably most of the weekend. That is my traditional place. I also will be in my alter ego as an artist appearing in the Iron Artist contest, defending the Iron Artist title that I won several years ago before the event kind of lapsed for a little bit. So that should be a good time. I'm looking forward to that, and hope to see a bunch of people there.
Do you know when that's going to be?
I believe I was told Saturday afternoon at 1:30.
So I might not be able to be there, unfortunately, because of
yeah.
nature of the furry marketplace.
Yep.
Which would kind of suck. I would like to be there, but...
Yeah, I know schedule-wise, they only have so much flexibility to do things, so...
Yeah.
Hopefully there'll be a good crowd. We'll see how it all turns out.
All right. Well, as always, we have our call for audience participation, suggestions, news items, general plugs. If you would like to be a guest, if you have a project you'd like to talk to us, like us to talk about, you can leave us comments on the website when they work. You can send us email directly, as Fuzzwolf did. I am TheNeech, all one word, at gmail.com. Greg and Buck, how about you guys?
Okay, I am GraveyardGreg at gmail.com.
And you can reach me at Buck C. Turner at baddogbooks.com, also on Twitter as Editor Buck.
All right. If you would like to sponsor the show, we have a sponsorship program that's based on three shows at a time, and I'll be happy to talk to you about that. You can contact me again, theneech@gmail.com. If you would like to subscribe to the show, we have an RSS feed, which is floating in the website in the coffee cup, or you can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. And you can also follow us as Short Story Geeks on Twitter. Or I should say, at Short Story Geeks on Twitter. So, come back in 2 weeks. Our next show should be... Well, we're not sure. The next show will be on the 19th if we can get it recorded. But that's also conflicting with further confusion. So it might be 3 weeks and the 26th. And we will have a definitive answer on that up on the website before the time comes. So, with that, all we need is a sign-off. Any ideas for a sign-off?
Well, I think Neil Gaiman said it best, that somewhere in the next year, you surprise yourself.
Works for me. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
This has been episode 18 of the Short Story Geeks podcast with your hosts, The Neech, Buck Turner, and Graveyard Greg, with additional material by Laurie Roby. Intro and outro music provided by the Rat City Brass at ratcitybrass.com. Incidental music provided by freemusicarchive.org and the PodSafe Music Network at musicalley.com. All music used with permission under the Creative Commons license or by its creator. Thanks for listening. Huzzah! We had a real sign-off this time.
Yes, and I'm going to say right now, we have to have a further confusion edition for the show. It can be done. It can easily be done after, you know, dealer's hours.
Okay. Well, we'll work out something.